Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. We begin this hour with something we can all relate to, the pursuit of health and happiness. In an emotional conversation with America's highest-ranking doctor, Vivek Murthy, the U.S. Surgeon General wears his heart on his sleeve, talking about his own struggles with loneliness. He came to London for the World Happiness Summit this week, and his timing couldn't be better. The Global Mind Project claims the U.K. is the second most unhappy country in the world. Meanwhile, in America, a new report says that for the first time, young people there between 15 and 24 aren't as happy as their older peers. Dr. Murthy says social media silos and addictive smartphones are making us more anxious and depressed than ever. And he wants lawmakers to step up now. Surgeon General, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
You are in England. I mean, perhaps people would be surprised to know that you're here for a happiness summit. In fact, we're talking on International Happiness Day. Why? Why is it needed? Mm-hmm. What is the problem with the deficit of happiness?
Well, the problem is that, you know, happiness is intrinsically linked to health. You know, when we are not feeling happy, when we're not feeling fulfilled in our lives, it affects how we show up at work, at school, in our communities. But it also ultimately has an impact on our physical health. We've now learned over the years that there's a strong connection between our mind and our body, how we feel and how we are. And the more we've learned about that, we've learned, for example, that issues like loneliness and isolation have tremendous effects in increasing the risk for both depression and anxiety, but also for heart disease, for dementia, and for premature death.
Are you surprised? And I know that you are Yorkshire-born. In other words, you are a Yorkshire lad, let's say.
Yes. Are
you surprised that this country, I mean, you know, pretty close to top of the tables in the OECD nations, is the second most unhappy, depressed country in the world? Only Uzbekistan has it worse. We're just going to play a couple of sound bites.
I think a lot of people can be taken down by the weather, but coming from the U.S., from California to here, I love it. I made a choice to move here.
People are just getting more and more downbeat by the fact that they're not being helped by the government, market forces, etc. And I think it just, yeah, it can be really difficult.
We're not that unhappy. I think the older generation is soon going to be happier than the younger generation.
Are you surprised?
Well, I'm deeply concerned, but I think one of the key lessons from this is that economic prosperity alone is not the key to happiness. And in fact, what we are seeing is that in many, many countries, which are increasingly modernizing in terms of their economy, their culture, et cetera, we're actually seeing that unhappiness is growing. And I think that's coming for a few different reasons. One of them is because we are actually pulling further and further apart from one another with the benefits and efficiencies of modern technology and ways of life. We actually have fewer friends that we trust. We have fewer relationships we can rely on. And that is a direct impact on our happiness and well-being. The other challenge, though, is I think technology has been a mixed blessing for us. And I think particularly when it comes to young people, the impact of social media on their mental health has often been quite negative, which is why last year I issued a Surgeon General's advisory on social media and youth mental health to point out the fact that when young people are using social media, as they often are, for more than 3 hours a day, they double their risk of anxiety and depression symptoms.
You have, in fact, gone even further, comparing social media and the tech companies to 20th century car giants, which have produced vehicles without seatbelts and airbags until legislation mandated it. What's happening in social media is the equivalent of having children in cars that have no safety features and driving on roads with no speed limits, no traffic lights, no rules whatsoever. And we're telling them, you know what? Do your best. Figure it out. It's insane.
Yeah, that is what we've done to our children. We've put them in unsafe, untenable environments, and we're hoping for the best. And you know who else we've place the burden on? Our parents. Parents all across the world are trying to figure out how to manage social media for their kids. These platforms are rapidly evolving. Many parents never grew up with them. And what they are finding is that their kids are often exposed to extraordinary harms, whether that's violence and sexual content, whether it's content generated by the algorithm that in some cases tells them to harm themselves. And the experience itself, many young people tell me, has led them to often feel worse about themselves and about their friendships. Yet, they feel they can't get off of it because the features that are built in are meant to maximize how much time we all spend on them. And that is a profound source of concern for me as a doctor as I watch the profound and disturbing health effects on our kids.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Yes.
Did you have personal experience as a child with any kind of loneliness that informs your, you know, that your zeal for this?
I did, Christiane. I struggled a lot with loneliness as a child. I was shy. I was introverted. I didn't have a lot of people who were from similar cultural backgrounds or immigrant backgrounds. And I ended up feeling quite different and left out a lot. And that was really hard. But what was particularly hard for me, Christiane, was that it was the shame that came with that. I came to believe as a kid that something was wrong with me. That's why I was lonely. Something was broken. Maybe I wasn't likable. Maybe I wasn't lovable. And even though my parents loved me unconditionally, Christiane, I never told them about these struggles because I felt ashamed. I have felt this as an adult at times too, these struggles with loneliness. After my first stint as Surgeon General, in fact, I was left without a work community. I had largely neglected my friends and family as I allowed myself to get inundated with my work. And I bore the consequence of that later when I felt profoundly alone and lost. And I think a lot of people go through these struggles. We don't talk about them often, but they're deep, they're profound, and they're part of the human experience. If you experience loneliness from time to time, it's one thing. If you reconnect with people, that loneliness goes away. It's when it's prolonged, when it's deep, that's when it starts to have impacts on our health and well-being. And if we can just talk more openly about this, if we can recognize the power of showing up in each other's lives, of checking on friends, of putting 10 minutes aside each day to reach out to people we care about, we can make a big difference in how connected we are.
That's one aspect of the loneliness. The other aspect, as you said, is the social media. And you, I was staggered to read that you'd gone to several universities in the United States, and where there should be chatter and connection, there was total silence.
Yes, this is one of the most striking things on the university tour that I did in the United States, was just the volume on the campuses and in the dining halls was much lower. I remember when I was in university that the loudest place on campus was actually the dining hall. We would all finish our classes, come there, and everyone wanted to talk, and catch up. But not only is it quieter there because people aren't talking, they're on their devices.
They ask you, how are we supposed to even meet people and have conversation?
That's right, because it feels intrusive, they would say, to approach somebody when they've got their earbuds in, when they're looking at their phone. And the less you do it, the harder it gets, because our social muscle has to be built over time. If we don't exercise it, meaning if we don't interact with other people, start conversations, engage in person, that muscle becomes weaker and in-person interaction becomes harder and harder. And that's what we're seeing with our kids.
And so, of course, now everybody thinks AI is going to be the replacement, you know, for romance, not just dating apps, but actual robots and things. Mm-hmm. What's your view on that?
I think it can be tempting and easy to look at AI as a panacea for all ills, and it might be easier and more convenient to turn to a chatbot than to go out and build a relationship. But these are fundamentally different. There is no replacement for in-person human connection. It's how we were evolved over thousands of years. We were wired, hardwired, to connect with one another. And we've got to intentionally build that back into our life now because it is slipping away.
Vivek Murthy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Christiane. Good to be with you.
And coming up later in the hour, superstar Olivia Colman on her new movie and what trolls did before there was Twitter. But first, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to press on with a military offensive on Rafah. IRC President David Miliband joins us with the humanitarian consequences after the break.
This is about human survival, and that's why it's a failure of humanity.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It would be impossible to complete the victory without the IDF entering Rafah, and this in order to eliminate the rest of the Hamas battalions. Soon, we will also approve the plan to evacuate the civilian population from the battle zones.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu there, following his latest call with President Joe Biden, seeming to wear his dismissal of the president's concerns as a badge of honor. He's offered no plan yet for the safety of more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah, or for expanding relief, or for getting the Israeli hostages back amid stalled negotiations. The International Rescue Committee calls the imminent famine in Gaza a profound failure of humanity and entirely preventable. David Miliband is president and CEO of the IRC. He's also former British Foreign Secretary, and he is a child of Holocaust refugees. This week, he joined me here in the studio to sound the alarm. David Miliband, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Christian.
So, the WHO, you all, everybody is really trying to sound the alarm of what is, we can see by the pictures, this impending famine. Who do you blame for this?
So 2.2 million people don't know where their next meal is coming from. And the million who are at risk of famine, imminent risk of famine, in level five, represent the fastest degradation, the fastest acceleration of a hunger crisis that's ever been seen. Now, how do you explain that to get you to your question? So you've got a series of impediments, blockages, restrictions being put in place on lorries carrying the most basic humanitarian aid. And it's not getting through to the people who need it. That's why you're ending up in the situation where what are frankly fourth and fifth best alternatives, dropping aid from the sky, building a pier that's going to be online in another 6 weeks, that won't help the people at imminent risk of famine now.
What possible reason could a democracy at war have for denying the basic elements of survival?
Well, no good reason has been given. There's one part of the argument which I think is important to get clear, which is that some of the trucks are being turned back because of allegations that some of the items on a truck might be quote-unquote dual use. In other words, they might have civilian use as well as military use. Let's be clear what kind of items we're talking about. A pair of scissors for use in a health centre. And when a pair of scissors gets found on a truck, the whole truck gets turned back.
I want to place, just so that our viewers and you also really hear from at least one person there, of the desperate hunger that they face.
What has this child done to suffer from hunger? I cannot find him milk for 5 shekels or a packet of milk from the agency. There, the normal milk is for 150. There is no work, There's no food, no drinks. We are eating plants. We started eating pigeon food, donkey food. We are like the animals.
I saw you shaking your head. I mean, this reference to them eating animal food is shocking still every time we hear it.
Yeah, and remember, the International Phase Classification Report that came out the day before yesterday, 25 children have died of starvation already. So this is about human survival, and that's why it's a failure of humanity.
You know, I just keep thinking Somalia, Ethiopia, all these famines that we've covered, all these food deliveries, all these urgent interventions by the US and others to save civilians. Why is this one different? Well, why is this one allowed to happen?
This is different because of the speed of the onset of this famine, because of the virulence of the attacks. And I say that plural because, remember, there are 100 hostages,
yes.
More than 100 hostages,
yes.
As well as more than 2 million Palestinian civilians in Gaza at the moment. This is the depth of this urgency, but also we know the depth of this political crisis, because every humanitarian emergency is also a political emergency.
Yeah.
This is a political emergency of really global significance, and it's one where our role as humanitarians is to be the expert witness of what's actually happening on the ground, because the testimony that you've managed to play of the Palestinian woman from Gaza mirrors what our staff are seeing on the ground in Gaza, both our own medical staff who are working with medical aid for the Palestinians, who are our partner for our orthopedic surgeons group, our emergency medical teams, but also local NGOs. We're absolutely clear, the International Rescue Committee, as a humanitarian organisation, that the dual humanitarian imperative, a legal and moral humanitarian imperative, of protecting civilians from fighting and of delivering aid to civilians, they can only be met by an immediate and enduring ceasefire. Remember, this is a legal as well as a moral imperative and a legal right that these people have, not just to life and limb, to survival, but to aid delivery.
Legal and moral, an incredibly important reminder. You can watch the rest of that conversation online at amanpour.com. Coming up on the program, Oscar winner Olivia Colman on her new movie and what trolling looked like before social media. But first, from the archive, my 2012 interview with the last Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, and how Vladimir Putin set out to destroy his democratic legacy. That's when we come back. Welcome back. President Vladimir Putin sailed unopposed into a fifth term, the only surprise being the brave protest vote that had been called by Alexei Navalny before his death in prison last month. Putin's iron grip on power is years in the making, part of his imperial worldview to return Russia to what he considers its glory days. And he spent more than two decades systematically and often brutally reversing any of freedom's advances, rolling back the legacy of his predecessors, Boris Yeltsin, and especially Mikhail Gorbachev, who famously brought perestroika and glasnost, a new openness to the Soviet Union even before its collapse. 12 years ago, just after a teary-eyed Putin had won his third term, I sat down with this last leader of the Soviet Union to talk about that election and how it would speed the decay of Russian democracy. Mr. President, many people call you the father of democracy, certainly many in the West and many in Russia. But many are also saying that Russian democracy, if it's not dead already, is dying. Why is that? What went wrong?
Well, during the election campaign, a lot of critical things were said about democracy in Russia. And you're right, there is a problem. But democracy is not dying. Because when 100,000 people, hundreds of thousands of people actually, protest in the public squares, when they demand free and fair elections, when they are ready to take risks for democracy, it means that it is alive. Because above all, democracy is the participation of citizens. However, the institutions of democracy are not working efficiently, not working effectively in Russia, because ultimately they are not free. They are dependent on the executive. They're dependent on what we call telephone law, the rule of the executive. And that is what the people are protesting against. They want real freedom. They want real democracy. They want a democracy in which the people's voice is decisive.
In fact, you've called Putin's democracy, or the current Russian democracy, an imitation democracy. Do you think that President Putin is committed to any kind of reform, and will the people's voice be heard under his presidency?
I said on the eve of the elections that if the president and his entourage in the future will just continue to try to fool the people with this imitation, that will not succeed. People are protesting, and people might protest in much stronger ways if he just continues his old ways. I think it'll be hard for him, given his nature, to do this, but there is no other way for him but to move toward greater democracy in Russia, toward real democracy in Russia, because there is no other way for Russia to find a way out of its dead end, in which it is now.
In the meantime, about 7 years ago, President Putin said, quote, "The collapse of the Soviet Union was the biggest geopolitical disaster of the century. For the Russian people, it was a genuine tragedy." He's talking about what you did.
Well, you are stating that I engineered it.
Didn't you?
You will not find in any of my speeches until the very end anything that supported the breakup of the Union. The breakup of the Union was the result of betrayal by the Soviet nomenclature, by the bureaucracy, and also Yeltsin's betrayal. He spoke about cooperating with me, working with me on a new Union treaty. He signed the draft Union treaty, initialed that treaty, but at the same time he was working behind my back. And that, of course, is not, frankly, policy. That is, I think, deception. And let me tell you that our friends, including our friends in the United States, they spoke very sympathetically about the need to preserve some form of union. They said that it should be preserved. But at the same time, when the breakup started, they were rubbing their hands. They were rubbing their hands, I would say, below the table. And by the way, Yeltsin and his team felt support from certain members of the U.S. administration, such as Cheney and Gates, who established a channel of communication with Yeltsin.
To many people around the world, you are a hero, a once-in-a-generation actor who ended the Cold War. How would you like your people to remember you?
History is a fickle lady, and you can expect surprises from history, but I do know that I did what I did and that I can be proud of what I did.
And you can. And yet, sadly, even today, there are reports that the Kremlin is engineering further crackdowns on dissent and free expression, taking a page even out of China's online firewall. Still to come on the program, actress Olivia Colman's new movie, a 100-year-old scandal that resonates more than ever today.
Oh, would you return my patty pans before the trial next week? Just in case I don't see you for a long while afterwards. Ta.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to the program. Long before there were Twitter trolls, there was pen and paper. A time when writing offensive letters landed people in prison, and a mystery that gripped the whole of Britain.
Bloody heavens. Carry on. Dear Edith, you foxy ass old whore.
In the end, I think it's just jealousy.
Do you feel certain Rose Gooding's guilty?
I can't see why they think it's me.
I'm on the verge of making history here.
I was a bit boisterous once or twice.
The new movie, Wicked Little Letters, is inspired by a real-life scandal and a string of anonymous poison pen letters that rocked the sleepy town of Littlehampton on the English coast in the 1920s. The movie stars Olivia Colman and is directed by Thea Sharrock, and they join me now from New York. Welcome to you both, and thanks for being on with us. So, Olivia Colman, you play a kind of a buttoned-up lady of the era in this seaside town. This very gregarious Irish young girl comes to the town, played by Jessie Buckley. You become friends, and then you're dealing with a string of poisonous, horrible letters that are being directed to you, and it's about who did it.
Edith Swan, who I play, on the face of it, is a pious Christian, sort of the perfect woman of that time, and very well behaved, lives still with her parents and still weirdly sleeps in the same room as her parents.
Oh, that's weird.
Weird. And and then Jessie plays Rose Goodley, who in that period, everybody looked at as, a shocking example of womanhood and an unmarried mother. But these two women become friends. They sort of see each other. Because we find out that behind closed doors, Edith is not having a nice time. And it's not a particularly loving household. And this friendship sort of starts up, but then something happens, which... Because I'm not sure how...
Yeah.
Spoilers, we don't want to do spoilers, do we?
Okay, so I'm going to take it from there then.
Start arriving.
I'm going to take it from there because this investigation then starts when you start getting these poison letters. Those are the wicked little letters of the title. And Rose, Jessie Buckley, gets arrested because she is thought to have done this. I want to play one of the clips.
We did it.
We
did
it. You're charging her?
Under libel, not a small offence.
No, it isn't. But what's the evidence?
Motive, timeline.
You let me out of this state, you agent!
Similarities in the language.
So I can see you both laughing as you're listening and remembering. And I mean, so much of it was bleeped that we can't figure out what the heck is going on. Was there a lot of that on set? Are you all pretty potty-mouthed and you were allowed to deliver?
Shall we tell the truth?
Go on, Thea.
Olivia's incredibly potty-mouthed.
Is she?
So is Jessie.
Butter wouldn't melt in your mouth.
And actually...
Thank you.
No, we all are.
We all are. We all like it.
Proudly.
Yeah. I think it's a nice seasoning of language.
And isn't it a bit restrictive when you go to try to promote this thing and you can't really show any scenes or talk in that vernacular?
Well, that's why we don't do live telly. I get quite nervous and I get a bit more sweary when I'm nervous. I'm really trying not to say anything bad now.
You're doing really well.
I really
You're
am.
Doing really well.
Amazing.
What are your favourite swear words?
Oh, now, you see...
Can we say it?
American audiences really aren't keen on my favourite word.
No. See...
Can you imagine what my favourite word is?
I'm not going to say it. I will be lambasted and pilloried.
Well, I do maintain that it's actually quite a cultured word because Chaucer did use it, but is my favourite.
OK, well, we'll be bleeping that. Thea, do you have one?
I thought you might.
Well, I like to counterbalance, so yes. I go with bollocks.
OK, I think we can keep that one. That's not too bad.
Great.
Yeah, sorry. Thea wins. Olivia, you're clean out of luck. Thea, you began your career, with amazing theatre here in the UK, and I wonder whether you see in what you've done, not just from where you started but where you are now, whether roles for women are beginning to be taken as seriously as they should, because women... Are they considered now big box office draws?
I would say yes.
And actually, I mean, research suggests that they've always been big box office draws, but they have chosen to say don't get me started on the pay disparity, but male actors get paid more because they used to say they draw in the audiences, and actually that hasn't been true for decades. Yeah. But they still like to use that as a reason to not pay women as much as their male counterparts.
Yeah.
In our industry.
And should I ask you?
I just totally jumped.
Yeah, yeah, let's ask Thea, because I want to know what. Yeah, tell me, yeah. Do you have a pay disparity? I mean, you're an Oscar-winning actress, Olivia.
I'm very aware that if I was Oliver Colman, I'd be earning a lot more than I am.
Really?
And I'm not saying I'm absolutely, yes. I'm aware of, I know of one pay disparity, which is a 12,000% difference.
12,000%?
Wow. I'll tell you about
that later. Oh, gosh.
Yes, do the maths, I know.
Well, look, on that note, Thea Sharrock, Olivia Colman, thank you both so much for joining us. Wicked Little Letters.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
And the movie is out in the UK right now and in the US on March 29th. I'm Christiana Manpour in London. Thank you for watching, and I'll see you all again next week.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.